Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
Co-founded by longtime crypto lawyers Gabriel Shapiro and Alex Golubitsky, the mission of MetalX, which means beyond law, is to separate law from nation states in a manner similar to how Bitcoin separates money and Ethereum finance. Their goal is to combine legal structures and autonomous tech to create best-in-class solutions, serving DAOs, devs, and internet denizens with a suite of interoperable autonomous legal solutions, which they refer to as MetalX OS. Alex, Gabe, Eric, Prepop, we'll start with the big question. What is MetalX? And Gabe, I'll turn that over to you.
Yeah, MetalX is basically a combination law and tech project to make law cybernetic and make DAOs cybernetic, right? So right now, probably the biggest pain point for DAOs is connecting with the real world and dealing with legal issues. And by combining smart contracts with legal entities, we think we can accomplish that much more effectively for DAOs. And conversely, a lot of legal solutions are purely in the off-chain world. People enter into legal agreements, but a lot of times those, even if they relate to crypto, they just are purely rely on traditional enforcement mechanisms. But we really have this amazing technology that can trustlessly implement agreements called smart contracts and blockchains. And so the idea is also to make law more effective by implementing contracts and transactions on-chain as much as possible in order to reduce trust in people.
And Alex, you're a co-founder. When you think about the need to create this set of on-chain protocols and off-chain legal arrangements, what comes to mind as a driving force to the creation of MetalX?
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed in just my practice in crypto law is that the need for legal structures and legal entities around protocols often interposes trust relationships and intermediaries where they're not necessary when you actually look at how the transactions can be accomplished on chain. And so one of the things that really drove me to MetalX and really wanting to create something new is to take, as Gabe was saying, the same ethos of trustlessness and permissionlessness and applying that to legal structures instead of trying to make blockchain structures meet the lawyers, bringing the lawyers to the blockchain.
Thank you for that. And so I thought it would be good just to briefly introduce each of you. And Gabe, why don't we start with you? We'll go to Alex, Eric, and then Prepop.
Yeah, my name is Gabriel Shapiro. I've been a lawyer for around 14 years, sadly. The first seven of that, I was a big law buy-side tech mergers and acquisitions attorney for a big Wall Street firm. And the last 7 years of that, I have been doing crypto law in various guises. Most recently, before MetalX, I was general counsel of Delphi Labs.
I'm Alex Golubitsky. I've actually got Gabe beat. I've been practicing law for 17 years, also sadly. And I've been full-time in crypto law for about 3 or 4 years. And before that, I specialized, my background's in international tax. So before that, I specialized in U.S. territorial tax incentives, so in the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. And that was my entrance into crypto, was through working with folks who were relocating to Puerto Rico to take advantage of those tax incentives.
I'm Eric Dylas. I've been practicing law for let's say 7-8 years. Started out as a secured finance and corporate attorney, mostly aviation finance, deals involving aircraft, basically. Taught myself Solidity starting in 2020. Always had a bit of a technical background and really liked how much power you get in one language, programming smart contracts. So I was really excited by that. I wound up leaving my firm, going out solo, became outside GC for API3 and helping build MetalX strictly on the dev side, which is a lot of fun for me.
I go by Prepop, and I've been a software engineer for 12 years. I started off in the
defense industry in electronic warfare and was very involved in cryptography and got very involved with early Bitcoin and altcoin mining and watched Ethereum as it launched. I had a series of defense startups that I worked on, and there was some point where, you know, watching smart contracts evolve and all the excitement of decentralization and code executing on nodes decentralized around the world made me want to make the switch full time, and got involved in a lot of EVM projects, Ethereum-based projects, and DeFi, and ran into a lot of the issues that Metalex hopes to solve, and was very happy to join on board and very excited to be
here. That, y'all, our head dev specializes in electronic warfare. It's over.
I was going to say, Prepop, what's it like working with three lawyers? But we can save that maybe for another podcast. I want to get into some of the terminology, because I think a critical part of the paper and the work that you've done, Gabe, and Metalex has done is introducing new terminology, new concepts, and new ways of thinking when it comes to the law and devs. Can you define first what the term Borg is for those who are unfamiliar?
Yeah, it comes from, it's not exactly an acronym. It's a way of shortening the term cybernetic organization. And we coined it really to try to differ. So many things were getting called DAOs, ranging from something Curve DAO or MakerDAO at one end of the spectrum, or Bitcoin itself or Ethereum itself could sometimes even be called a DAO, all the way down to like a venture capital fund that happens to use smart contracts with it, or a group that sprung up and just wants to buy a copy of the Constitution, right? And these are like very different things at these opposite extremes. And so just realize that it's quite useful to have a term for something that is more like a traditional entity or business that happens to use smart contracts to express or enforce its rules, versus a protocol DAO that is meant to be this nation state transcending, like, eternal grand smart contract system that doesn't rely too much on extrinsic legal arrangements or social activities, et cetera. And so the term Borg is meant to capture these things that are more like traditional business entities that use smart contracts as part of their logic, but aren't these pure crypto economic flywheel systems.
And when people think of DAOs, there's also a whole spectrum of entities that come to mind to people. When you think of Borgs and the main differences between a Borg and a DAO, where do you see that distinction falling? Because sometimes if people stretch the definition of a DAO, they could end up in a place like this. So where do you guys see the main distinction being?
There's a few distinctions. Number one, I would say DAO should have lots of voting members, like a large decision-making base, right? They will most likely be slower to make decisions as a result. They need to have internal politics, right? And they should probably be focused on making really important decisions as a result of that, right? You can think of the American electorate maybe as like similar to a DAO. It's a very large voting group, but they don't weigh in on everything, right? They elect officials, and then the officials are a little bit more agile than the officials elect, like, regulators, and they're even faster and more agile, right? And on the Borg side, it's groups that are a smaller group of decision makers. They have a narrower mandate. You might have a security Borg that's just in charge of, like, deciding when a protocol is being attacked and perhaps freezing it or taking some other actions in response to that attack. Narrow mandate, but they can act fast. And there might be like 7 or 10 or 5 decision makers involved in that. So that's the main distinction. And then I would say with a Borg, it pretty much, in my opinion, should be mandatory that there's something like a legal entity that has like an express written contract that expresses, that sets forth the rules for it. Whereas with the DAO, you could do that. You actually can wrap a DAO in like a Cayman Islands foundation or something, but many DAOs are unwrapped, and I wouldn't say that's necessarily a mandatory part of being a DAO. And some may say it shouldn't be part of a DAO because they might have cyber anarchic ambitions for their DAO.
One thing that I was going to add just on the sort of distinction between a Borg and a DAO is that complementary is that Borgs really embrace the idea of legal personhood. And so a Borg is definitionally an entity, like a legal entity that's recognized as a person in the law. Whereas a DAO, as Gabe said, certainly can be that or can be embodied by that. But fundamentally, a DAO is a network and not necessarily a person in the eyes of the law. So one of the reasons that we like to implement Borgs is it's a way of managing personhood for a DAO.
And Eric, when you think of the idea of a Borg, is there an example that comes to mind, or how should clients, and this could go to anyone, but how should clients or potential or projects that are looking for counsel or considering a Borg, DAO, Panama, foundation models and others, how should they think about whether or not the Borg, it makes sense for them?
I like to keep it pretty short in that I see them as just parameterized smart contract enhanced entities. And each of those components exist on a spectrum. So there are certainly different types of more prepackaged Borgs that Metalex is steering towards, and I'll probably popcorn to pre-pop for that, but that's how I like to envision it. Keep it simple.
Yeah, and pre-pop, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that and where you see the non-legal actors in this space taking advantage of the Borg system.
To me, a strong reason that non-legal people would consider Borgs is right now there's a lot of protocol founders and DAOs and people that are participating, whether they're doing certain efforts to further a protocol. It could be business development efforts. It could be development efforts. A lot of them aren't really sure how to even become a legal entity or have some kind of representation. And there's a lot of worry about overhanging liability. What happens if something goes wrong? Who's at fault? So I think, to me, it helps establish a way to have siloed liability and siloed responsibilities that could still be a part of a larger DAO without having to say, well, this whole DAO is wrapped into an entity, because then you still might have some of the same problems, right? I think very specific focused. I think Gabe uses special purpose vehicle companies, very isolated purpose Borgs. Really help give definition to some of the roles that are in protocols and DAOs while still letting it be decentralized.
Yeah, and I think like a key point here is that there already are like things like this, right? Like you can look at like HATS protocol, or I think it was called like Pods protocol or something, or like Squads on Solana, or the idea of sub DAOs, like DAO on Cosmos has this sort of like sub DAO functionality. So on the smart contract level, like people have been doing things like this, and also just in the general like sphere of people talking about DAO governance, there's been this idea floating for a while of what's sometimes called constrained delegation or sub DAOs or like councils or things like that. The key thing, why I really felt like a new term was needed, and what I feel like is an important part of the additional twist we're trying to put on that philosophy, is the idea that, okay, yes, having these different roles through a smart contract or through a multisig or a sub DAO on chain are good, this on-chain permissioning scheme. But when you actually look at the functionality of how these things are advertised, like people are calling it, let's just say it's a grants multisig, right? There always seem to be a lot of social rules that are advertised as part of that are not reflected in the code itself. So like you might see, hey, let's fund our grants council, and maybe they're using the HATS protocol or something to do it and to like get authorization from the DAO to spend the money or whatever. That's great, but then there'll be a bunch of rules like this money can only be spent for the benefit of this DAO, right? Okay, even just with that simple thing, you said that in a forum post about this, right? But as a lawyer, I have to think, okay, what does that mean exactly? What is the significance of saying that in a forum post? Does that mean that when this proposal is approved, all the people who are on this grants council are bound by that as if it's a contract? Maybe. And so then if they like give a grant that's not for the benefit of the DAO, can someone then sue them? Okay, who can sue them? For how much? Under what circumstances, right? And so it's contract-like, but it's just not going far enough. So what we should do is actually make that official, because it's not in the code, and we should embed that in the rules of an entity that actually wraps this multisig or this sub-DAO or whatever it is. So that's really, I think, that's where I see the Borg concept really adding something over and above the DAO governance concepts that have come before.
Yeah, and I think that flows into the idea of cybernetic law quite well, right? This idea that law can be consciously integrated within a cybernetic system to improve the functioning of the legal system, whether it's efficiency, even just the equitable nature of it. Wondering if you guys could define what you mean by cybernetic law, what this looks like, because I think cybernetics is something that appears quite often in the paper.
When we talk about cybernetic law, one of the things that we're trying to get at, you have this quote that's often quoted, often misquoted, of code is law. And so I don't necessarily subscribe to code is law. I think they're two different things, but there is this concept of, we'll call it rulishness, where a computer network outcomes are very rigid and predictable. So if you do the same thing 100 times, you'll get the same result 100 times. Whereas law is necessarily more flexible to where people can use discretion and come into judgments. There's these concepts of equity where you can take, okay, here's a situation and we can find our fact or judge or whomever can analyze what is fair, or perhaps within a contract, discretionary tasks can be delegated to one person or another. And maybe there's more than one correct way to do that task as delegated. And so I look at those things as somewhat of a spectrum, right? You can have more rulish systems and more flexible systems. And when I talk about cybernetic law, what I think about is bringing those two poles a little bit closer together in a legal system and creating zones that are clear to participants where there will not be flexibility, and allowing participants to opt into rulishness. And then within those rulish systems, you can have ecosystems of contracts and dispute resolutions that are settled automatically and without additional human intervention. And as law becomes more cybernetic, those areas where people can opt into, hey, we're going to use this alternative system that's not necessarily reliant on the discretion of state agents to adjudicate disputes and that type of thing, you get this sort of cybernetic version of the law. And in a sense, we already see it, because we already see in things like arbitration and these other ways of avoiding legal disputes. Like, you look at a term of service for a website, right, which we've all, I think, been involved with as attorneys, drafting them, reading them, et cetera. You have, okay, but when you click this button, you're giving up this whole slew of rights and you're opting into this whole system of dispute resolution. And I don't think that that's necessarily perfectly implemented on the internet as we have it today, but I do think we're moving in the correct direction, where market participants can agree on sets of ground rules, and those ground rules can then form the entirety of their relationship without relying on state mediation if there's a dispute or a problem.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I also think, to me, cybernetic, so cybernetic, the term cybernetics comes from Kubernetes, which means steersman. Right. So it's something like piloting a ship, for example. And originally, it's a term coined by Norbert Wiener to talk about feedback mechanisms in both animals and machines. And so what I always picture it as just like an extension of Google used to have the phrase, don't be evil. And then it became very evil as a company. And in crypto, we have this phrase, can't be evil, which is a deliberate phrase on that. And to me, cybernetic law is the legal version of can't be evil. We can all, in law, there's this concept of efficient breach that like the Chicago school came up with. We're like, hey, if you, if you're party to a contract, but it's not like the most efficient outcome for you to obey that contract, you could just breach it and pay damages, right? And you'll still be in profit, right? That is the philosophy of most modern law. And crypto goes against that, or can enable you to go against that by creating these immutable smart contracts that enforce prior expectations, right? So I literally think of it as it's an unbreachable contract, right? You can create unbreachable contracts because you can embed, you could say, okay, this group of people is getting this amount of money, right? And they're only supposed to spend it on X, Y, or Z. And if X, Y, or Z are like specific addresses on the blockchain, then you can hard code those in, and you give them enough discretion that they can choose between X, Y, or Z in a certain case, but they can never choose A, B, C, D. They literally can't do it. They cannot breach the contract because the multi-sig is holding the money. The multi-sig is whitelisted to only interact with these specific three addresses. And so you literally cannot breach your agreement. To me, that's the epitome of cybernetic law. It lets you do can't be evil for law.
Yeah. So to me, as someone that wasn't a founder and didn't have this bubbling up in my thoughts for months and months and penned a white paper and all of that, it really is the natural conclusion of where technology and the legal aspects of a relationship are inextricable, whether that's by nature or by choice. So there's an existing concept that demands both, or let's say the arrangement is being elected to have this sort of cybernetic tech law hybrid. And it tends to arise where one is inadequate or insufficient by itself. So some of the problems that Gabe was talking about, the legal aspect or the technical aspect, were not fully fleshed out, or they didn't accomplish the goals. They didn't adequately assuage the fears or address the negative externalities of certain situations. You have to marry both. You have to marry the immutable tech and the legal parameterization around things that are going on, and you get something very powerful from it.
And Prepop, before I turn the question back on the lawyers, I'd be curious, in your experience with working with tools in the smart contract space and cryptography generally, do you see there being an issue with what may be a lack of understanding from non-coders, non-devs, particularly lawyers, who will now be working with a technology that they might not fully understand? And then I'll turn it back to Gabe, Alex, and Eric on that. But curious your thoughts on that, Prepop, and how you see maybe the non-technical side of this playing out.
In their interpretation of the smart contracts?
In their willingness to work with smart contracts that they might not fully understand or be able to audit themselves.
And we had talked about this as a company, that readability in the contracts is pretty important. And I think, and now I'm heavily biased, right? Because I've been coding for a long time. But I think Solidity is on the easier to read side as far as programming languages go. And there's recently been a lot of emphasis on gas efficiency, which is a very important subject, especially for certain uses of smart contracts. But I think for ours and on the legal side, we wanted to put an emphasis that gas optimization wouldn't hinder the readability, especially for lawyers, and try to put an emphasis that of that in our smart contract. But there is a point just in users of cryptocurrency, users putting money into a smart contract, whether it's an ERC-20 token or otherwise, there is a huge disconnect of, can someone interpret the code to realize they're going to lose their money or not, or how much risk is actually at play? And I think at the very least, the industry in cryptocurrency does a much better job of transparency of if the contract is verified, and not all are, but if the contract is verified, you can actually see what's going on. And there are tools, AI tools, that you can input the code to try to check for vulnerabilities and things like that. But at some level, it's a disadvantage not to be able to interpret what's going on in the code. I'm not sure if I'm straying too far from the question here, but I do think one of the very neat aspects of this is that you have the side that spells out the legal restrictions of, let's say, a Borg, of a multi-sig that has these constraints. But someone can very easily go in and see exactly what they can interact with on the smart chain, on the blockchain through the smart contract, without a doubt. And that's a lot stronger than taking somebody's word or an agreement, like Gabe was mentioning, of, are they going to break this contract, but they'll still make money on it, so it's still worth it to them, versus they can't even take this action because they're not allowed, because the smart contract code physically prevents it from occurring.
Yeah, and Gabe, I'll turn it back to you, because I love the phrase can't be evil, especially when it comes to technology, when it's so important to embed that in the code itself. The one thing that comes to mind, I think, to most people is, okay, the code itself might not be evil, but perhaps it can be manipulated. Perhaps there are bad actors who choose to use it the way it's been coded to do, but maybe manipulate prices. There's numerous things that could be done there. How do you see that evolving? The idea that this code could be, well, maybe not perfect initially, or that obviously the goal is that it's perfect, but how do you see that evolution between the law needs to act in a appropriate, equitable manner, but at the same time, it will need to go through growing pains?
Yeah, that's exactly why there always are gaps where the code doesn't cover all conduct. And that's why we try to have rules. Like one example you can have is, let's just say it's like a grants board and people are not supposed to give grants to themselves. You actually, because like blockchains are very Sybil attackable because the chain only knows addresses, there's no people, they could violate that rule, right? Even if we make it a legal rule in the docs, they could still collude to violate it. So one of the things, not to get too granular here, but for example, if you wrap if the legal entity type you choose for such a Borg were to be a Cayman Foundation, an interesting feature that they have is called the supervisor role. And what the supervisor is supposed to do is be the one that enforces that the entity follow its own rules, right? Because unlike a typical like corporation or something, there are no owners of the entity, right? It's almost like the entity itself is almost like a smart contract. That's how foundations work. So what we can do is say in the foundation documents, okay, if the DAO that originally set this Borg up passes a vote saying, we think there's been a violation of the rules by the people running this Borg, the DAO can actually appoint an emergency supervisor, whoever the DAO wants, right? And that automatically is legally effective under the foundation's documents, under the Borg's documents. And so that person could come in, would it be legally authorized to investigate, potentially sue people for breaking the rules, remove people, replace them with new people, that sort of thing, right? So this is just like an example of how you gap fill and how you always have to be looking at the interplay between the law and the code. I think more broadly, though, this connects up with what we describe as our phase three, right, which is separating law from the construction of nation states, right? Because I think there are going to be all kinds of areas in blockchain where there are some people feel like other people have done something wrong, but the code itself, the rules have been followed, right? You can look at like protocol hacks, quote unquote, where people feel like they have their money stolen, but everything happened in accordance with the code, right? It's not like validators changed the code or did like a reorg of the blockchain. Someone just found like a clever little trick inside the code to get more money than people originally would have thought they would have been able to, right? And a really good example of, and then so whenever this type of situation arises, you have a legal type of situation, right? Like in the real world where there's two people who disagree about whether some rule has been broken, that's when they go to court and have a dispute, right? And so we need blockchain versions of this. There have been some like Kleros, right, which I don't think is fully satisfactory for a variety of reasons, mostly because it just plugs into existing law actually at best, right? It's just it's almost like choosing the ADR or something, or choosing Delaware Rapid Arbitration Act to decide your dispute. It's not a crypto native law, right? But a better example of where this will be needed is with Circle's transaction reversal protocol, which they've proposed, where basically, like, you can imagine a world where actually every transaction has a reversibility window where for 45 days after the transaction, someone can say, do a smart contract transaction to tell the protocol, hey, this transaction was by mistake, or this transaction is nefarious and I want my money back. And you can imagine that there needs to be like some sort of dispute resolution procedure to decide this. You could choose the real world for that dispute resolution procedure. You could choose the Delaware Chancery Court or something. But personally, what I think we need is like our own new crypto native standards of how this stuff should work and create our own kind of courts and our own kind of system for resolving these things. And it's very greenfield. Again, the only thing that's really been tried are these sort of token betting systems, right? Where basically you make people bet some money on what they think is the correct outcome. And if they lose that bet, they're going to be hurting, right? So it pays to vet with the majority, but that's not really law. That's like tyranny of the majority. So I think we can evolve way more from there, but we need these kinds of experiments. And I hope once Borgs are really popular and like we have really cool like deal technology between Borgs, the next step would be to say, okay, when people disagree about how a deal went down and whether it was the right thing or not, we also have these like really good crypto native on-chain courts to decide that.
And even without courts on chain, we've seen things like the Ethereum fork, right? Where, and I think the paper does a good job of mentioning that as well, where now all of a sudden you had this off-chain activity that led to a decision that some didn't agree with, frankly, a lot did, but it was this social consensus that was reached and a decision was made. And one of the principles that you highlight in the paper when conceptualizing Borgs is qualifying autonomous code when necessary. And Alex, I thought I'd turn it to you to share what that principle means and what the other two principles are and why they are important.
Yeah, so it actually ties into to what I was talking about a little bit earlier with the need to have discretion in certain instances, right? Where you have, where rigid rules are going to produce undesired outcomes, right? And so looking at, Gabe was talking about with the Circle reversibility standard, You have a desire where, okay, you click a bad link, whatever, you end up getting your USDC drained out of your wallet. Well, hey, in that instance, maybe like immutability is not great if you're the person who got scammed, but it would be better to have somebody able to come in and be like, yeah, okay, that guy got tricked. He should get his USDC back. And that is very hard to do that type of thing with a computer, right? Maybe there's like very black and white cases that you can have binary outcomes, but really in those circumstances, you need a person to look at it and say, or a group of people to look at it and say, okay, we've evaluated everything. This is like the correct outcome. And so I think that one of the things that we want to describe is, as Gabe referred to it and as referred in the white paper, is this discretion gets embodied with this concept of the human in the loop, where you have a computer network that has carved out space for human discretion to exist. And I think that it's just important to be extremely clear about where we're going to have deference to code and where we're going to have deference to human discretion. And so I think that's what we're building towards, is a very like refined conception of where those two things meet and where those two roles exist and where they can overlap.
And Eric, I think you sit at an interesting spot given your transition to working into the code is law space. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on how autonomous law will work in the near future. Because I think it's easy, it's not easy, but one can look long term and see this efficient system that operates effectively. Tokens are transferred, rights are embodied in certain tokens. But to get there, we'll be building a puzzle. And so I'd love to hear what you think over the next couple of years, how this idea of autonomous law will be incorporated.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. It's naturally beholden to shelling points, Overton windows, these almost psychological concepts of what is the correct, ethical, optimal, Pareto efficient outcome, and how that kind of leans on how the guardrails are defined and made. And it's there are always going to be gaps that get smaller, that get moved, but the concept itself is one of a more appropriate system. So you're starting from this basis of a kind of bespoke rules and almost like a society under which the participants, the technology, the concepts, the transactions, they all congregate around a more appropriate way to judge outcomes, prevent further harm, just enable a system that's a little more appropriate than trying to shoehorn jurisdictional concepts on a jurisdictional technology stack. And the insane amount of inefficiencies and unknowns and collateral damage that comes from that.
Yeah, and one example in the paper is this deal technology. And I think it's an important concept to highlight, given before we started recording, we were talking about all the costs, whether it's monetary or time, that are associated with deals in not only the tech space, but just general corporate transactions. Gabe or Alex, I'll turn this one to you guys. Could you describe what DL technology is and why it's fundamental to the three phases of the roadmap?
The idea of DL technology is to take a lot of transactions that are currently done using legal agreements or even done on handshakes sometimes, and to try to really implement them to be transactions that are done through on-chain means between on-chain entities. A great example of this is actually just like the idea of doing a token swap, right? Like anyone who's been in crypto a long time and done like OTC deals and stuff knows that it's just like, it's just a mess. And it's so strange in crypto, right? Because at best, like a lot of times it's just like a handshake deal in a Telegram. Like I'll sell you like X amount of such and such token for this much of another token, often a stable coin. And they just say, okay, we agree. And then who sends first? Obviously, whoever sends first, since this is a bearer asset, is taking a lot of risk because the person might not then send their half back. And even if you do a legal agreement, we have this concept in corporate law of a closing. It appears in real estate law as well, right? Transactional law generally, right? Where like there's all these conditions to the deal going through. You have to deliver a closing certificate that says the representations are still true. You have to show that the money is ready to send. If it's like a stock purchase, you have to sign over the certificates, but all these sorts of things, right? Or sometimes there's a legal opinion involved saying that everything, the transfer of title will be good. Sometimes there's like a debt financing thing where like the bank has to deliver its note saying that the credit is available and so on. And all these things are supposed to line up at the closing, right? And then everyone like finishes the deal. So these are like basically like conditions. But there's no reason why most of these should actually have to be like so manual and stuff, or like why one person should have to go first and take the risk. Instead, like you can line up everything programmatically, right? Some cases it might require confirmation through an oracle. And then if and only if all conditions are true, then the transaction just automatically executes, right? And the funds are like locked up trustlessly in the sense that if all the conditions are satisfied by time X, then it will, like the tokens will trade, for example. So actually Eric has designed an amazing smart contract protocol called LexGrow for us that does that. And yeah, I think he could talk more about the architecture of this, but it is the epitome of what deal technology should be.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for that intro. So I have always been obsessed with this notion of conditional immutable escrow. It's what I did as a law firm associate, what I pulled my hair out over many hours on end. And it was just absolutely shocked to see the bare layer of security that these sometimes nine-figure closings were conditioned upon. So last year, I built a sort of a more fleshed out, powerful smart contract escrow protocol. And one of the interesting features of it was that you can make the transfer, the release from escrow based upon an oracle condition. You can base it upon numerous things, but let's use an exchange rate as an example. You can say if this exchange rate is below this amount, this relative exchange, then transfer. If not, you can keep trying until expiry, that sort of thing. Then I came across the sort of condition manager concept that Prepop made actually for Borgs, and quickly realized that it could be this notion of a condition-based escrow release can be even more powerful by incorporating multiple conditions instead of requiring all of them, requiring one of them, that sort of thing. One of the things I'm doing for MetalX is I'm adapting this project I built last year called Chainlocker into LexGrow, which is, again, a more powerful, flexible smart contract escrow that will involve several different patterns, whether it's a double-sided escrow, so tokens for tokens, that sort of thing, one way, lots of different options there. And it's going to be especially useful for borg-to-borg commercial agreements. Instead of, I guess it's a new B2B, borg-to-borg, that's the plan.
Yeah, one sort of other analogy is if you look at what makes DeFi unique and how it can uniquely use blockchain, is there's all these financial transactions which can be composable or interoperable using tokens and smart contracts. So you can take a whole financial transaction and perhaps wrap it in a token or a smart contract that can then be used in another fashion that's sort of built on top of it. So when we think about like these, as Eric called them, borg-to-borg B2B transactions, like one thing that I think we'll start to see is that this same concept that we've seen play out in DeFi can actually play out in legal agreements, where we start to create legal agreements that are actually composable, and we can have agreements that are built on top of the initial agreements due to that mutability. And so I do think that's going to be a lot of fun as we see it start to open up. And we're unique at Metalex in that we're a integrated law firm and tech company. But I actually think that this is a trend that's existed for a long time with standardized sets of forms for different types of documents that everybody uses and become the industry standard. So if you see one lawyer who did a deal, it's okay, I know the forms they use, so I know how to build on top of this in a subsequent financing or whatever. I think that'll become more rigidly set into code, and you're going to see over the next 5 to 10 years a lot more of what we're doing, where law firms are just integrated with tech companies because the agreements themselves are going to become reduced to code.
Oh, it's so interesting to think about, especially to everyone's experience when they join a big law firm, is to look at the precedent banks and have the lawyers, whether it's the partners or even senior associates, refer to those banks as the starting point. And I can just picture a future where the code base is this starting point. And I can imagine you guys do as well, too. So it's exciting to think about that possibility of coders and lawyers working together. And this is, I think you guys are such a good example of that happening. Curious if you have any feedback on what you've learned from bridging this gap between code and law over the past couple months.
This guy named Prepop just keeps doing electronic warfare on all my machines. It's very unfortunate. He calls it pen testing or something like that, or peen testing. I'm not exactly sure, but I'm just under constant attack, and I've become very paranoid.
I think that it's been super useful to work with software engineers as an attorney, because I think as lawyers we tend to like gloss over things and perhaps get comfortable with things like being a little bit vague, even in agreements. And when you're designing code, you just can't do that. Everything has to be in its place and well-defined. And in fact, I'm sure Prepop's going to answer this question next, and he's going to say the exact opposite thing that I'm saying. But like, I actually think that I would be a better lawyer if I had worked with software engineers earlier, because it actually refines my way of thinking about agreements. And I can turn it over to Prepop now to talk about how working with lawyers has made him a worse software engineer.
I wouldn't say that. But there are some unique challenges, like reading through some of the specs that get written up. Some of the conditions are like, you need to handle every condition that could possibly come about. And yeah, okay, you just need a full Turing complete programming language, and there you have it. But okay, you want something that's contained into a system, that's modular, that can hook into a broader legal system, crypto legal system or financial system. And so it comes down to an approach of flexibility. And I would say one of my core stances on crypto is that I'm a big immutable code maxi. I do not like the upgradable proxy paradigm of, well, we can replace, what if there's an issue when users' funds are at stake? That's the nature of the game, in my opinion. It's just like if you were a startup of a company that made hardware, and you're going to ship the hardware out. And if there's a problem with the hardware, if you don't get it right by design, that's it. You have to accept the fact that there was a failure. And so I just view that there's a concept of, that gets glossed over too much, of the real risk of, if there is an immutable contract, what are the consequences? If one or two or three people are allowed to upgrade that select few, or what happens if there's regulatory or legal pressure on the admins of these contracts that force them to upgrade it, versus what's truly decentralized and can't be changed, unless there is, if we talk about something like the Ethereum fork, where entire chains are branched to save something. But that kind of concept is a lot requires so much more of a shift than a dev just upgrading a contract. And I think by design, I'm treating it a lot like hardware design, the initial designs and concepts, and that when this ships, if there needs to be something handled in the future, a new concept that we haven't thought of, there will be a way to interface. There will be a plug. There will be an adapter that allows it to be immutable. It's not to say we won't have administrative control in the contracts to unhook things or plug new things in, but I think it's important at a core that these things are immutable. And I think that a lot of lawyers, I would say the lawyers that I work with are a lot stronger proponents and vocally supportive of contract immutability than some of the devs that I've worked with and some of the people in DeFi and things. Because it's scary, right, to have code, and once you launch, that's it. The code's deployed, especially if you're talking about funds and actions that could have consequences in the future. But I think lawyers really get that concept of, like, okay, if you're touting decentralization, if you're touting that this is a autonomous smart contract, it's got to be immutable to the point where you can't just replace it with something else if pressured.
Or if it can be replaced, then it has to be, like, that's definitely something that a DAO should do so that it's all the relevant stakeholders give consent. But yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And I think that I mean, this might be too far afield from what we're talking about, but I think that the regulatory environment that we have, at least in the United States, tends towards rewarding immutability. And so a lot of lawyers who are advising clients on regulatory issues will just be like, well, everything should be immutable because that then we can say it's decentralized and the government will leave us alone. Maybe rightly or wrongly, but I think that is a sentiment that exists among lawyers. And I think that there is, that you may end up with a lawyer saying, hey, this should be immutable, and a dev saying, yeah, but we might need to upgrade it because it might not work. And it gets at the tension that Prepop's talking about, which I think exists in any event, but is really exacerbated by the current regulatory environment.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Go ahead, Prepop.
I was just going to say, I would agree with that. It definitely influenced my opinion of immutability, the regulatory environment.
Yeah, and speaking of the regulatory environment, right, we've seen such a different approach to crypto in the US compared to the EU, compared to Canada, the UK, and many other countries. For crypto native systems to become polycentric, which is something that you guys talk about in the paper, and I think is the long-term vision here, how can a system be created so that we can have more Metalexes spring up in the wild and more coders and lawyers working together to create these systems that not only exist, but compete with each other and ultimately make each other better and make the world a better place? Because now we can have more efficiency, we can have more equity, and we can have this immutable, can't be evil set of rules.
Yeah, there's like a few different ways this could happen. And that's like the most distant part of our roadmap. So I won't pretend that we've fleshed out all our thinking about it or like the exact plan. One thing I would say is that we actually already see this, right? Like we already have like proto crypto native law and like proto crypto native courts and like proto crypto law polycentrism. Like just compare the Cosmos ecosystem to the Ethereum ecosystem, right? Like in Ethereum, MEV is like very allowed, normal. It's just considered part of the deal. And then there's this whole ecosystem for trying to make it done in a bit more of a fair way. In the Cosmos ecosystem, MEV is more considered something forbidden, that there should be no MEV, right? And they can do that because the validator set is smaller and more socially accountable for each Cosmos chain, because like it relies a lot on this delegation mechanic, which doesn't really directly exist in Ethereum, right? And so you always have the threat that people could revoke their delegations if they perceive you to be like an antisocial validator, right? So although these aren't law as such, they're very similar to law. And if someone does MEV on Osmosis, for example, there is if a validator does MEV, there's a pretty high chance that the rest of the validators and their delegators will get together and pass a governance proposal to confiscate some of that validator stake effectively as liquidated damages. And on Ethereum, meanwhile, there are these other kind of protocolish mechanisms just for making sure that MEV is done in a fair way. And if those were violated, then maybe the person would be socially slashed. So we already see it, right? These are already two competing legal systems in a sense. So that will just naturally happen through like market forces, different applications, different preferences, different technology stacks, different strategies. And so that's one answer, is just like markets always find a way to create themselves, right? Another answer I would say is that we could try to make that process more conscious by like directly incentivizing it in certain ways. So let's just go back to the example I gave earlier of Circle's proposed reversibility protocol. We could create a protocol on top of that protocol for dispute resolution, and then we could create a protocol on top of that protocol, on top of that dispute resolution protocol, for selecting like which people get to participate in that dispute resolution protocol, right? And it's that meta protocol that would be the source of polycentrism, by basically incentivizing different types of players to come in and compete with each other for the right to adjudicate a certain disputes. The way court systems work now, basically, is for the most part, you have, if you're in Delaware and you have a corporate dispute, you're going to wind up in the Delaware Chancery Court, and you don't actually even get to pick the judge. But you could actually, and even if you did get to pick the judge or the court, they're all bound by a single law, right? The law of the United States and the law of Delaware. But you could imagine where there are these different courts, which might actually be like Borgs or something like that, that each say, hey, here's our idea of what the law should be. If you hire us to decide this dispute, this is the law we're going to apply. It's a package deal. And there's this other one that applies this other law, and they compete with each other for customers to decide a particular dispute. And you could imagine this sort of, this being its own layer that has its own kind of like Lex governance token or whatever, that people stake and they get slashed if they do a good job, they get more of it if they do, they get slashed if they do a bad job, they get more of it if they do a good job. There's maybe some kind of like peer review appeals process where they also can get slashed. So this is the kind of thing I'm interested in designing in the third phase. And yeah, we'll keep thinking about it more, but I think something like that is possible.
Thanks for that, Gabe. And I think what you guys are building is exciting, and it'll be really interesting to follow what the next couple months look like. The white paper came out, I think, a week ago now. And so there's a lot of work to be done, and I'm sure you guys will be really busy. The last question is, if people want to get involved in what you're working on at MetalX, how would you guys recommend they do that?
Yeah, there's a few ways. You can go on our website, metalx.tech, that's T-E-C-H, and there's a waitlist option there. So we'll definitely pay attention to that waitlist and form a mailing list out of it and things like that. We also have I believe it's a public Telegram group called MetalX. If you can't find it, you can DM me at LEX_NODE, the same as my Twitter, on Telegram, and I can point you to it. And that's like a community chat for the moment where we'll be posting updates. We also have a Twitter at MetalX_labs, and we'll be posting everything there as well. You can try to DM there as well.
Another thing that I'd like to see for people that want to get involved, a lot of what I view MetalX doing, especially in the first phase with Borgs and the smart contract work we're doing there, is really, you know, trying to empower token holders and add more token holder rights that are built into the smart contracts. And I think, too often protocols have gotten into, kind of a sloppy, maybe unintentional a habit of making promises that the token can do this or has a claim to this or that. But in fact, you're just trusting whoever's on the multisig that can make the decisions and has control of the funds. And it doesn't have to be that way because we have smart contracts. And so a lot of the thought that Gabe has put in is, where can the token holders start to get a feel for what the true power is written in the smart contracts and their authority. And if founders are making promises or protocols are making promises, then it's time to put those promises in a smart contract because the technology's there. There's no reason not to. And so I'd love to see a big movement with, people that are investing in crypto projects to not only, make sure there's an audit on the technical code of a project they're investing, but also, put pressure on what rights are actually established for token holders in smart contracts or through the governance and kind of a shift in how they view this.
Awesome. No, this was great, guys. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, Matt. Great job as always. Really appreciate it, dude.